We're bantering with Bensley again this morning, and it's great to have our special guest on. I talk of a gentleman who, well, we're going to learn more about, but he trains so many good horses. Horses like Stylish Century, Dignity Dancer, General Nadim. He celebrated Group 1 races. He celebrated all sorts of races, and he's still very much involved in the world of thoroughbred racing. It's a good morning to Bill Mitchell. How are you, mate?
Hello, Andrew. I'm very well, thanks.
Thanks for spending a little time with us. You're still very young, but you've had a lot in your life, Bill, around the world of thoroughbred racing, as I've just said.
Well, yes, I suppose I have. I worked around the world before I took out my trainer's licence at Scone and then Warwick Farm, and then I moved to Randwick and had stables in Queensland, Victoria, New South Wales. Trained a lot of horses, a lot of nice horses for a lot of good people.
Bill, you're obviously, your family are famous with Yarraman Park and Arthur and Harry are there and the like, but people might sort of think, oh, I was just going to be racing for you. Was it always that way, or were you always looking maybe at something else?
I didn't want to be a horse trainer until I was 70, that's for sure. I never had that in my mind. I had a good career as a horse trainer for 25 years, and it was, for me, it was just time to move on. Since I've been involved in bloodstock since, with breeding and consulting to people on racehorse purchases, broodmare purchases, stallion purchases. I'm an investor in breeding stock and racing stock. I'm a trader. I have a few irons in the fire, and it keeps me busy enough without having those crazy horse training hours.
The early hours. Sounds like you were glad to get rid of them back in 2006.
Yeah, 2006. It's a while ago now, but I don't miss it that much. I don't. There was obviously good bits and there were tough bits, but it's a tough road of being a horse trainer. No matter how good you are at it, they work extremely hard, and I think we do understand that from the outside, but it's a very hard lifestyle.
Yeah, hands-on for sure. Hey, going back to your school days, you went to school and then you left, and you ended up in the Northern Territory for some time.
I did. I went up there as a jackaroo. I didn't really know what I wanted to do at that stage of my life. So I went up there for 6 months and chased cattle around, and it was enjoyable. But then I spent a bit of time back at the farm, and then the following year I went into the stock and station business in Tamworth. I got a job there, and I worked there for 18 months, which was interesting. And I hadn't really had any intentions of going into horse training at that point. I went over to England, and then I was travelling there, and I had to get a job, and I ran into family friends. We went and stayed with family friends, the Johnson Hortons in Berkshire, and he was a very good horse trainer, and staying there, he offered me a job, and that was where I sort of came in at the bottom level of horse training, and just loved working in the racing industry and with the racehorses, and the whole training side of it was sort of where I found my passion, which I think we all just stumble across it sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes we do. That time you were in your early 20s?
Yeah, I was 21 when I went over there. 21.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you spent, how long did you spend in the UK? Because I know that you went UK back home and then to America, didn't you?
Yes, I had 18 months in the UK, nearly 2 years, we travelled horses to France and all over England, and worked with a couple of outstanding horses. Ilda Bourbon won the King George, and Double Form was a great sprinter who both went on to stud. And it was a strong stable at the time. And then when I did come back, I got a job with Neville Begg and worked for him for nearly a year while I was organising myself to head over to California and worked for Neil Drysdale for 2 years.
So was that something that was organised with Neil, or did you just go to America looking for something?
No, it was organised through a bloodstock agent who was a friend of mine called George Blackwell, who sadly is long since gone. But he was a great family friend, and he organised, he used to buy a lot of the horses for Neil Drysdale, who was a private trainer at the time, for a wealthy Texas family. So all the horses belonged to one owner, and it was organised. I went over there and stayed there for a couple of years and loved it. Thoroughly loved it. Travelled all over America, Saratoga, San Francisco, all the racing places, Lexington, Oak Lawn, all those tracks went all over the place.
Mm. And do you still look back? I know you're not a trainer now, but when you were, did you learn from the UK and America? Because their racing is different to ours, obviously, but were there parts of that that you used on your horses here?
I think America's more similar to here than the UK. The UK's, you know, they've got beautiful training facilities, but it was then fairly basic horse trading, in a good way. They're conservative, yeah. And all the uphill gallops on beautiful turf surfaces, but you didn't see the issues that raise their head more so in America and to some degree here, where you're training on track, and the issue of keeping horses sound is probably more relevant. And going back to those days, there wasn't really swimming pools and water walkers. Mm. Certainly no water walkers. America were much more active, proactive, I suppose, in keeping horses sound.
Yeah, I understand. So after a couple of years with Neil Drysdale, you came back here. When you came back to Australia, was it the love that you just wanted to be a trainer?
Yeah, I did. I wanted to get involved. I had to make up my mind whether I get another job for another trainer. I think at that point I was 26 years old. So I trained a few horses out of Scone while I looked around for somewhere possibly to go and get started. And then I moved to Warwick Farm. Must have been about 1982, I think.
Mm.
So,
and was that looking back on
5 years?
Yeah, I was just going to say 4 or 5 there, and you spent time at Randwick as well through your training life, didn't you?
Yeah, after Warwick Farm, I got stables at Randwick. I only got a few boxes at the top of the hill there, 14 boxes, and I reduced my string and was fortunate enough out of the 30 I had in work at Warwick Farm to bring sort of 14 to Randwick. And amongst those horses was Liverstone Elaine and From the Planet as unraced late 2-year-olds, and they went on to be sort of the two horses that probably got my career established.
Well, From the Planet is a very special horse for you.
I owned a quarter of him, and I bought him as a yearling for $19,000. He won over $600,000 back in the mid to late 80s. He raced till he was 7. As did Liverstone Lane. They were similar horses, but Liverstone Lane didn't ever win a Group One, but he was a wonderful horse to me, and introduced me to some new clients. Lots, you know, it really opened the doors and put me on in a situation where I was able to go out and get some clients and keep finding people to buy new horses.
Yep, understand. With From the Planet, you mentioned you owned a quarter. That's probably pretty important when you win a big Group One.
It was. You know, I had Stylish Century around that same time. I just got Stylish Century, and those horses almost paid for half my house, you know, in over a couple of years. It's probably more difficult to do that nowadays for young people, but it was certainly a great stepping stone in my career and my life.
And can you remember the moments of winning your first Group One?
Absolutely. Yeah. The huge crowds at the races in those days on Epsom Day.
Yeah.
It was probably a bigger race then than it is now. I think the Springs, not what it was in Sydney, but certainly was a big race, and for me to win a Group One, I think I was 32 years old. It was really important, and I was able to keep building from there.
Yeah. The you mentioned around the same time, the list of horses that you had that made group races, that won Group One races. You mentioned Stylish Century. We were discussing yesterday, Bill and I, just off air, having a chat about things, and I'm glad you reminded me. I knew he had a great deal of trainers, but he ended up with 7 trainers, Stylish Century, and fortunately you were one of those.
I was the third of 7, and I think I trained him for 18 months, and he won about $1.5 million in that time. So he was very good to me. We went to Japan with him for the Japan Cup, and the 7th trainer was the owner. He finally got a trainer's license, was able to do it himself.
Dick Monaghan, you spoke of. Can I ask you, some people might go, gee, was he a difficult bloke to train for, or was he close on hand with the way that he wanted you to do things with Stylish Century? What sort of a bloke was Dick Monaghan?
Well, I think one of the things that Dick realised about the horse fairly early on was that if he didn't lead, he didn't run well. So Dick was adamant that the horse would lead every time he went around. And funnily enough, the few times he was ridden quieter, he didn't fire. So I think unless he went into a race and realised there was a race on, if he went in and was trying to ride him quiet, he didn't think it was race day. So, I think owners probably study their horses almost more carefully than trainers in many instances, and can pick up things and idiosyncrasies that just purely by the fact that they watch the video 10 more yep. times than the trainer might.
Yeah, I understand. How good was he? I mean, he won a Vic Derby and he ran second in a Cox Plate for you, but we move on quickly in this game, but reflecting, how good was Stylish Century?
I think he was a brilliant racehorse. He was racing against Faux Rogue and the Phantom, Superimpose, just trying to think of these, Better Loosen Up. Yeah, it was a great weight for age.
Great time.
A couple of years there. They were very, very good. And he was right there with them, right there with them.
He was. I want to talk about General Nadim because his history is going to go on in the Australian bloodlines for so many years, Bill.
Yeah, he was a brilliantly fast horse. Probably a little unlucky in the slipper, which was the first time that he ever got beaten. He ran fourth and he didn't lead that day. He probably should have. It was one of those slower run slippers, and I think he could have led and he possibly could have won, but that wasn't to be. And then he went on and won a Lightning and a Newmarket. He won 12 of 16 starts. He was a bit stiff in a Caulfield Guineas. He really was an outstanding racehorse and brilliantly fast, which, of course, probably was one of the main reasons that he was such a good stallion.
Yeah, for sure. He, as I said, he's going to stay with us for a very long time. Those early days with him, I mean, he won his first 4 races in Queensland. He then came to Sydney. You mentioned the Golden Slipper, but he won the up and he won the San Domenico, the up and coming, the Heritage, the Stan Fox. He won the Lightning at Flemington. He won the Newmarket. He went to Brisbane. I mean, he was just an out and out star.
Yeah, he was. He was, and he could run 1400, and he was dominant on his day. He was dominant. Wasn't good on softer tracks, but he slipped at the start of a Doomben 10,000 and ran third, probably was very stiff that day, had to come from way back. He nearly fell at the start on a wet track that didn't suit him. He was a wonderful racehorse, wonderful racehorse.
Chief De Beers beat him that day.
Yeah, yeah.
You would have sold a few General Nadims in your years as a bloodstock agent, wouldn't you?
I think recently I buy for some Hong Kong people and I advise some people here. Joe O'Neill, Prime Thoroughbreds, I help him with his purchasing along the way. And he's got a very successful syndication business and does a great job there. Recently, I bought a horse that ran third in the sprint in Hong Kong. jockeys up in New Zealand, a horse called Beat the Clock, who he's won $17 million Hong Kong dollars in two seasons. So he's a Hinchinbrook horse that's really seriously effective sprinter in Hong Kong. Actually, I bought his grandmother as a yearling at the old English Easter sale, Snippet's Lass, who's the mother of Schnitzel and of Hinchinbrook. So she's really going to be recognised in Australian bloodlines for a long, long time.
Yeah, will be for sure. Another one of your nice horses, and we're talking with Bill Mitchell this morning in our banter segment here on Sky Sports Radio, was Dignity Dancer, an Australian Guineas winner. Was that horse, did it always have the qualities, Bill, of winning some good races?
We put him through the breeze up for Keith Biggs, and he got sick before the sale, got a temperature, and we didn't breeze him up very fast. But at that point, we knew we had a good idea that he was a very, very smart horse. He's extraordinarily clean-winded. You couldn't make him blow. He'd gallop with other horses, and they'd be dragging their heads, and he'd just walk off like he hadn't done anything. And once he hit a mile and 2,000 metres, he held the track record for 2,000 metres at Flemington and Randwick for a long time, both tracks. He was a brilliant, brilliant middle-distance racehorse.
When you look back at the horses that you've trained, when you look back and you think, was it from the Planet and Liverstone alone that you spoke so fondly about a few minutes ago, that they could have been the flag bearers? Or do you look at General Nadim and Stylish Century and those? What are the favourite ones, Bill?
I think I had some wonderful fillies along the way, fillies and mares, Group 1 winners like Arrogant, Electrique won two Group 1s for Nick Vass, who still races a lot of horses in his black and white colours. And I had a beautiful mare that my parents owned called Let's Hurry, who didn't win a Group 1, but she won, I think, three Group 2s, was second in a couple of Group 1s, raced till she was 7 years old. She was a wonderful mare, and I remember her very, very fondly. Retired the Yarraman and was always around till she died. It was Arrogant was a favourite. Very sadly, was killed in a race incident. But a Group 1 winner and a beautiful natured Rory's Jester mare who could win up to a mile. She was a brilliant race filly. Lots of good horses. Yeah.
And I should mention, in that time, you retired as a trainer back in 2006. But in that time, you did move to Melbourne, didn't you, from Sydney?
I did. I moved to Sydney from Sydney. I trained there in Melbourne for 3 years. I got offered a complex at Caulfield that was almost, it was state of the art, I guess, probably was ready to move from Randwick, try something different. So I went to Caulfield and had reasonable success there, but I think I was running out of gas by then.
You were starting to get sick of those early 3 a.m. calls, were you, mate?
Oh, well, it wasn't. It was fine, but I was sort of just about, I think it was just becoming very difficult to make a decent amount of money for the work that was going in. And, I still had a lot of good clients, and it was a tough day when I had to ring them all up and say, look, I'm going to move on now. And, a lot of them are still very good friends today.
Yep. I say this in the right way. We see the Freedmans, they move around a little bit, Lee's in Singapore at the moment and whatever. Do you find, or did you find it hard, Bill, at that time you thought, I've done this for a period of my life, I want to do something different, or I'll stay within the game, but I want to do something different? Are you a bit of a mover?
Little bit, perhaps. I certainly knew that I didn't want to be horse training anymore. I wouldn't say I'd be highly unlikely that I'd ever want to do it again, but in different circumstances. I think it's the training on the tracks, and I know Chris Waller and a few of the trainers are now sort of trying to change the hours and the way we do things here, and I still actually find it quite amazing that we're still training out of the middle of the city centres. It doesn't happen many places in the world anymore, but I think things will have to change along the way. in the next 20 years won't affect me, but things will change.
Yeah, yeah. It is, in this day and age, to get young people to get up, we need to attract them rather than pushing them away, don't we?
Well, young people can't be getting out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, some can, but it's very difficult, and
yeah.
It leaves them with no lifestyle, and there's really no need for it. I mean, why would you want to train your horses in the middle of the night? It makes no sense.
Yeah, understand. So you decided to retire as a trainer in 2006. Did you have the next portion of your life organised?
Oh no, but I knew that I could. I knew that I could get involved in bloodstock in different ways and consultancy and it's that's what I do, and I've set up Mitchell Bloodstock with my son now, and it's going very well. James, he's 29 and really into his bloodstock after 7 years at Inglis. He's very well educated and has a great understanding of horses, form, breeding. So that's going on. I've been at Sedgenau for 7 years now as their racing manager, and the number of horses in work now has reduced considerably. They're not buying as many horses, but they're breeding magnificent horses. The breeding record's extraordinary. I'm still there, but not in a full-time capacity. I'm still manage the racehorses, but it wasn't keeping me as busy as it had been when they were getting started. The Maloney family now breeding 50 beautiful broodmares, absolutely top of the class. Their Magic Million Draft this year's stunning, and not only do they look good, but they're racing well. Three 2-year-old stakes winners come off the farm.
Yeah, you mentioned the horses like I know Toby Edmonds has got a few Granny Red Shoes, and John O'Shea's got Pretty in Pink, and there's Winter Bride. But I want to focus in with your time with Sedgenau on Voodoo Lab. We saw it win the Group One, broke through for Sedgenau the other day. It's Kevin's first Australian Group One win, winning the Winter Bottom. You spotted this horse through the sales.
Well, Kevin every year likes to buy a horse for the Inglis race at Scone.
Yep.
And that was the first year that we did buy one, and it was the first crop of I'm Invincible. So I was sort of trying to find a horse for the Scone race out of the Scone sale. I basically thought I'm Invincible was a really genuine chance to be a good stallion, and he was a very, very fast horse. And if I'm buying first season size, I usually look at the fastest. And we were lucky. There was five or six I'm Invincibles in that sale. I think Yarraman Park had four from the top of my head. It's a bit vague. And Voodoo Lad was a really nice individual. He was obviously probably going to race as a gelding because nobody had any idea how good I'm Invincible was going to be, really. But luckily enough, we bought him for $36,000, and he's just under $2 million now as a 7-year-old winning Group Ones. He's been a wonderful racehorse, flag bearer in the Sedgenau colours. It's been really, really good.
And
also Noel Leckie, and Noel sadly passed. He bred the horse. And the great thing is that Julie and his son Campbell and daughter Sky race the horse now with us. And, they get a real buzz out of him. Particularly, obviously, going on and winning the Winter Bottom Group One, it's really been a wonderful story.
It has been for sure. You mentioned earlier Mitchell Bloodstock with your son James, and the selling of horses and buying horses and things like that. You mentioned you went to New Zealand at a Breeze Up sale and bought Beat the Clock, who was placed in the international sprint last Sunday. You mentioned how hard training was, but it must be a hard caper as well, a bloodstock purchaser and seller of horses, being in the right spot at the right time, Bill?
Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's just pure hard work. You have to do the due diligence. You have to go to a horse seller if you've got orders to buy horses, or if you want to buy something yourself as a trader or for whatever reason, breeding stock. It's all about doing your homework and understanding what it is you're buying, and that way you reduce the odds and give yourself a better chance of getting a good result.
So right now, We've got sales galore, catalogues galore probably sitting on that desk that you're at the moment. How do you go out and look at yearlings or select what could be there come, you know, January, February, March, April?
Well, we've already done a lot of hunter studs in around the Magic Million yearlings, which, of course, is such a big catalogue that you almost can't do it in the time you have at the sales, because the horses only arrive 5 days, 6 days before. So you've got 5 days to look at 1,000 horses. It's hot and it's humid. It's hard work. We get through a lot of the preliminary work on the farms in the Hunter. Yesterday I was in the Southern Highland. That way you go to the sale with a list of horses that you're going to look at. I mean, I'll probably cut out 50% of the horses in the sale, so I don't have to do them in the rush hour at the sale. So just makes the job a bit easier, but it takes a long time to get through 1,200 horses and have an understanding and know have all your ducks in a row so that you can be ready to act professionally and give everyone who you're acting for the best chance of buying a nice horse.
And Bill, with that, is there an art? Is there an art to buying a yearling? Many of our listeners are punters and things like that, but we often hear stories of the rich yearling, but there's a horse that's running in Brisbane on Saturday that we spoke to a trainer about earlier that cost $20,000 that could make the Magic Millions. It is a dream, isn't it?
There is an art to it, and there is a science to it, and some people are clearly much better judges than others. Some people get lucky, but as they say, the harder you work, the luckier you get.
So if there was one thing when you look at a yearling that's being sold at any of these sales, is there a standout thing that you look at?
I look for an athlete. I think everyone's much the same. You look for a horse that looks athletic. Often, sometimes the biggest, strongest ones might know that they're going to need to be gelded to be able to stay sound. You have to find the natural athlete. You have to look at the pedigree. It affects the value. Sometimes there's no point trying to swim in the deep end. They're just, you're bidding against people that own their own countries. So you've got to be realistic and find the horses that are going to fall into your bracket. And my clients, I know what they like, what they spend, and we have a discussion about the finances and, what we're going to spend on each horse. And then you do the best job you can, but you've just got to find a nice athletic horse, and sometimes you've got to put up with little what we call faults, confirmation faults. But if you like the athlete, then
go with your gut.
And then you go with your gut, and of course it has to be in your bracket, in your price bracket.
Yeah, understand. I know you have little other time to get it because racing is a bit like that. But I know you like swinging a golf stick occasionally.
I try to play. Once a week. I wouldn't be too far off that. I enjoy it. It's fun. It's relaxed. It turns the phone off. I've done it right back to my training days. Unfortunately, I'm not much good at it, but I do enjoy it, and it's a good chance to meet people, see friends, enjoy the golf and the vibe and getting out and having a nice walk around, and hopefully it doesn't spoil a good walk.
Yeah, no, exactly, which it couldn't quite often do. The game of golf, for sure, having tried to do it for my lifetime as well. Bill, it's been fascinating to learn more about you. It is an industry that you mentioned the training was hard at the end and things, but I think no doubt listening to you, you love doing it and you love what you do now. You wouldn't be doing anything else.
No, I'm not sure I can get a job anywhere else either, but at the end of the day, the industry that I've been in for nearly all my life, and I'm very lucky to be involved, and I really enjoy it. It's no pressure for me to get up and go to work. That's for sure.
Yep,
I really love
understand.
It.
Yeah. Well, we thank you for your time this morning. We'll obviously catch up at the sales over the next few months, but thank you for joining our Sky Sports Radio audience this morning and telling us a little bit about your life.
Pleasure, Andrew. Thank you very much.